So I wanted to introduce everyone to Margaret Braxton. For those who don't know her, Margaret's running Scales Payer Strategy and Research team, does excellent work for our clients, and continuing with Scales' curiosity and theme of exploring the payer landscape, which I've been doing for some time, but in terms of leadership series, most recently was represented by our discussion with Michael in January, which since led to a pretty robust document, article, white paper, call it what you will. We're now going to explore the landscape further with Margaret. So with that said, Margaret, as per usual, if you could give the group a little bit of background on yourself, I'll jump on mute and then jump back in for questions.
Sure, glad to. Good morning, everyone. Margaret Braxton, as Roy's just introduced me. My background is in healthcare, 35 plus years. I've worked on the provider side in a health system and behavioral health, leading teams on the operational side. And the other half of my career has been spent with payers, leading teams negotiating contracts. And that would be fee for service to full risk, both on the primary care and specialty space for United Healthcare and Cigna. So I'm glad to be here with you this morning.
Thanks, Margaret. So let's start the conversation with a focus on value-based care programs, and then we'll traverse down to or across to concepts of health equity and what that actually means in healthcare today. It's a term that's used increasingly, but I don't know that most people understand what's actually meant by it. So jumping first into value-based care, from your lens, having negotiated value-based care contracts on behalf of payers, what does the landscape look like today? What are the programs that are available? And how do those programs vary from one state to the next?
Great questions. So let me just start with this, that value-based care spreads a continuum. I think, Roy, as you're alluding to here, it is organized care that measures outcomes with alignment to a reimbursement model. And that's applicable to primary care and specialty spaces. Typically, value-based contracting aligns with the line of business. So commercial line of business, Medicare Advantage, and Medicaid, where that exists, a contract exists with that payer. The primary care value programs are similar across the spectrum, but we understand with population health, you're dealing with different age groups and different sort of social dynamics, right, with each population. If I took a step back, the things that are consistent in a primary care value-based model, there are HEDIS measures, clinical coordination fees, support, the infrastructure necessary to manage in a value-based model. Medicare Advantage, if you move that forward, has some other what we call livers, which we call MLR, which manages a percentage of the cost, right, spent on the patient. And so I wanted to start there. There are levels of value-based care. There are incentive programs. There are shared savings programs, and there are risk programs, which follow throughout all lines of business. If you ask, if I think about what varies across the country, in the Medicare Advantage space, it's similar. Each health plan is grappling with the same thing. How do they get healthier outcomes? How are they getting patients to in compliance with their healthcare, medication adherence, diabetic testing? So it's similar across the country. The execution of the type of model in the commercial space may vary based on state regulations. But again, it's very similar from state to state. And of course, if you look at South Carolina, you have a sicker population than you do in California. So there are variations based on the population, the health of that population. But they're very similar across the country and very similar across the pairs.
Given those similarities, why do we see an abundance of primary care, direct contracting, primary care groups in more states versus others? And you really see wide, wide disparities across the country.
So given the model, why do you see, given the value-based models, why do you see disparate primary care practices across the country?
No, why do you see an abundance of adoption, frequency, size, volume, activity in regions like Florida, California, Texas? And by comparison, despite their comparable population sizes and everything else, number of primary care physicians, number of practices, why do you see far less adoption in northeastern states, northwestern states? Why do you see these huge differences?
Right. So Florida, can we take Florida off the map for 1 minute while I answer that question in general, and then I'll go back to Florida. So
absolutely.
What's happening is that the value-based programs that are on the primary care side are just that. So you see aggregation, you see acquisition, you see models aligning, practices aligning together in IPAs. It's because the primary care models are moving to what we call total cost of care programs. And that could be risk or non-risk. What that means is, the patient is attributed to the primary care, and then it becomes wholly the responsibility of the primary care to manage the total cost of the care of that particular member. And so the funds are typically paid to the primary care, and then the primary care has downstream contracts with specialists and other entities that are providing care to that patient. Now, that can take many variations, right? But that's just one. But in all of them, the primary care is the sort of gatekeeper of the funds and the gatekeeper of access to care for that patient, not in a formal sense like a payer where you need a referral, but a very informal sense. They're accountable for the care of that member and the coordination of care for that member. And so you see primary cares aligning to that model for that reason. Where you don't see that, and it's difficult in some markets, Georgia, North Carolina, some of your Northeast, Louisiana, it's difficult where you have health system laden states, regions, markets. And that is because if you think about the dynamic with health systems, their revenue is generated by inpatient hospitalization, ED visits, outpatient testing, costing more than your freestanding imaging center, right? And so there's always sort of a tension between the health system participating and moving that forward in their way versus primary care's aggregating and moving that needle forward in the primary care total cost of care space. Does that help?
It does. It does. It's a very, a very helpful insight that I haven't heard described before. And it makes sense. Mm-hmm. Let's double back to Florida.
Okay. Oh, so Florida. Let's double back to Florida. Right.
Yeah, so Florida has been very, very busy in primary care, direct contracting, lots of new entrants, new brands. Some of the largest brands in the country have their origins in Florida, who have since gone off to IPO.
Right.
I don't know whether it's all of them, but I'm thinking of Oak Street, Kano, Genuine Health.
Yeah.
Yeah. A long list of them.
Yes,
why were they all so successful coming out of Florida, given that the Florida that I know still has some pretty powerful health systems?
Right. So Florida is, for most payers, has the number one member enrollee count in Medicare Advantage, which drives and draws primary cares to that state. A lot of membership, a lot of access needs. Secondly, Florida has a dynamic that is interesting to me that I've not experienced or noted in other markets that I've worked in. And that is, payers seem to have sort of a very, I don't want to say a different approach, but the applicability of membership thresholds and primary care programs and the ability to negotiate contracts with multiple payers in the same, I mean, multiple providers in the same market, same type of contract is very different. So for example, typically a threshold for a risk contract would be 5,000, 10,000 members. I've seen risk contracts with 1,000 members in Florida. The providers will say, it doesn't make sense for me to be in a shared savings program or an incentive-based program. I'm ready for full risk. Let's jump in at 1,000 members, and they're willing to accept that risk. From a payer perspective, if the provider is willing to accept that risk, and again, we're talking Florida, you're shifting the liability, the dollars, the cost, really to the provider and away from the payer. The payer thinks, okay, if that's really what you're able to demonstrate and willing to do. Now, when you're in a risk contract, there's reinsurance deficit coverage. There's a number of things that the provider is required to have in place. But Florida is just that, it's a dynamic, different state. Yeah.
It's interesting because I hear Humana described in New Jersey as an impossible party to negotiate with. And I see the same Humana in Florida referenced as, you know, the number one growth engine for certain provider groups. You know, Kano is a good example, long-standing strategic partnership, and a lot of that value creation is attributed to their very robust Humana partnerships. It's just, maybe I'm wrong in my facts, but it does seem to be quite interesting that the same payer brands play a very different role in one state versus the other.
Right. So Kano has been in place for a bit, and the Humana contract has been in place for a bit. In fact, when I was at Cigna, that Humana contract was in place. Humana this year has had a deep reorganization and a deep loss in funds. In fact, they've recently stated that they will be moving out of the group employee coverage business. And so Humana's financially is going through major overhaul. And so I'm not sure if some of the decisions were made prior to that or in light of that, right? So I think we will see different Humana emerging as we move forward. So I don't know any more details, right, about Humana's contract or other states.
Yeah, it's also interesting to know that as of recently, I think within the last quarter, a couple of the more progressive risk-based alternative payer groups that have formed, I'm thinking of Jared Kushner's brother and that group, Northeastern Origins. Jason, help me out with the name. Chiffy.
Drawing a blank as well.
Yeah, it's not Kano, but it sounds like it's got one of those quippy names. Someone on the phone knows who I'm talking about. they've since backed out of Florida and have said that they can't Oscar. Make their business. Sorry?
Mm-hmm. Oscar.
Yeah, Oscar, exactly. So the other Kushner brother, non-real estate. So Oscar has backed out of Florida. So what do you think of that?
I think Florida is overcrowded with providers. And I think in order to be successful in a value-based program, there are many things that have to be in place. One of them must be volume, and having adequate number of members, right, that covers catastrophic cases and allows you to provide robust care for that membership, in addition to value-added services, transportation, meet food insufficiency needs. And it's a crowded space. And again, there are players that I think don't have sufficient membership. And as they are finding that there's difficulty to have success, I think you'll find more backing out of the market. And just, it's inevitable. And then the players emerging that do this well and have sufficient membership to be successful.
Yes, that's interesting that the million plus population that has migrated to Florida in the last few years, net, half of which came from New York, that's a much younger demographic. Mm-hmm. So it's just interesting in terms of value-based cost-saving potential. They offer probably a lower potential. So let's shift away from Florida for a second. Other value-based care initiatives that seem to be introduced and then retracted. DCE, I'm not sure how the ISNP program is going. Do you keep track of some of these other variations of value-based care? And do any of them come with a warning sign? Because I think about them as an operator. If I've gone and built a huge business, sunk a lot of money into a DCE strategy, and suddenly it's removed from me a year and a half later, I'm left holding a bag. So right. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so ISNP, DSNP, they're still in existence. They are specific patient populations that fit into each. And so they will continue to be administered as they are today. DCE is still in place in terms of the direct contracting entity that was administered and still is administered by CMS, their MSSP Shared Savings Program, and now their ACO REACH, which is new just this year. So I think, I've seen what you're saying, especially in the specialty space, where value programs are deployed and later sunset, either because the value that was in that program has reached its maximum, or they realize that the intended outcome was not accomplished or achieved. Some value-based models you think will yield a specific outcome, and once you've deployed it, you realize, no, that's not the right. Either it's not the right levers in the program, or it just didn't accomplish what was intended. And so you take a step back, and you may then try another model. And I see that in the orthopedic space, like we've seen orthopedic bundles. They were deployed probably at least 10 years ago, starting with CMS. And then payers sort of followed, as usual. CMS informs the market. And the payers have now started to either sunset the program or change the programs, because up front, there were obviously savings, especially moving with site of service from inpatient to outpatient and or to an ASC. Well, once you've accomplished that initial savings, what else is there in that program to accomplish that realizes a savings? And so then the cost to run the program no longer makes sense because it's not offset by realized savings. So that you'll see that in the value-based space periodically.
Yeah, short-term wins versus sustainable wins. We had That's right. Insight from Yates at CHESS, who's very concerned about the troubles ahead for too much infrastructure built around short-term incentives. He highlighted that as the primary risk. It's in any thoughts on this segregation, it seems, between two groups, large payers, United being the largest, Cigna, Aetna, who are seeing significant wins, large profits, billions of dollars of earnings generated through other programs. You know, in the case of United, it's their reliance on Optum and Optum's reliance on provider ownership, 60,000 providers and counting, with a heavy focus on primary care, versus second group, the Centenes of this world, who are squarely focused on Medicaid as a payer, don't have much else going on, have recently acquired a few assets, but nothing too monumental, and have underperformed as a result. Do you think about the payer landscape in that context? Group A, very successful to the extent that they're becoming other, and Group B, you know?
Yeah.
Yes, I do. CVS, for example. Go on.
Yes. Sorry, I'm saying yes, I do. I didn't mean to overspeak. Yes. In fact, having been with United for a number of years, at some point there was a significant shift. So if you look at the, and I'm sorry, my brain is like moving ahead. In the commercial space, there's very little in the commercial payer space. There's very little profit margin. And so there was a shift once Medicare privatized Medicare into Medicare Advantage. And, you know, I think we've all seen a shift in focus on Medicare Advantage by just about every payer and a shift away from the commercial space. So that doesn't mean they don't continue to administer commercial benefits. But the focus is clearly on Medicare Advantage, Medicaid, and any government program. The space is limited itself, and so United Healthcare very early on created Optum. Optum is so large. I was speaking to United's New York CEO Friday, and he and I just sort of laughed because it's huge. Even United Healthcare employees don't have insight into all that Optum offers. So I'll just tell you some of the services that I know they offer. Bundled program services. So United Healthcare hires Optum to bundle their services. They now offer some contracting on behalf of United Healthcare. They offer education and training to United Healthcare and other payers around RAF scoring, coding. They have Optum Care now, right? So they have acquired practices all to manage that total cost of care and that dollar from A to Z. So they don't have to send that out, right? So they don't have to entrust and downstream contract with a specialty provider to provide that service. So that, and then they have their PBM. And so Cigna 3 years ago decided, hey, we're going to replicate that. And they created Evernorth. Evernorth is the business engine for Cigna, just like Optum is the business engine for United Healthcare. Aetna and CVS, same thing. They have a PBM and offer other services. So the services they're offering are not just to Cigna and Aetna and their members, but externally. And so that's where the success and the revenue generation comes, is by the business services entity. I think Centene and Emblem and, you know, these local, regional, small national players are positioned for acquisition if there's something unique they bring to the market. Centene has been successful in the Medicaid space. And so where a payer may not have had success there, one of the larger payers they may be interested in acquiring them. If not, then Centene will eventually not exist as we know it today. And we've seen that with small payers like throughout the years, right? They're either acquired or they dissolve.
So let's shift into health equity. And okay. Let's put on your health equity hat. So let's do basic fundamentals. From your vantage point, what do you think health equity means from a business standpoint?
So health equity means, and I'll just say this is what it means, and then we can talk about it from a business perspective. Providing a fair and just opportunity, right, to the highest level of care for all. We saw during COVID the magnitude of inequity and disparities in healthcare. While it has existed in our country for time, the pandemic was a light shone on our healthcare system in that regard. And so as a result, government entities, CDC, CMS, Health and Human Services, have made a public commitment to bring a shift in this area. And we know it's multifaceted. It is not one answer, it's not one question. From a business perspective, I think it's not new, but it's new in terms of it being a question on all of our minds, right? So we're being challenged now from many stakeholders to think about the intersection of health equity in the work that we do day to day. So for healthcare delivery, what does that mean from primary care to hematology, oncology to neurology? What does that look like? And what does that mean in terms of how we behave and the expected outcomes? So I don't know from a business perspective yet what that looks like, because we as a company are just beginning to examine that. I do know there are opportunities, though. I follow a company called CityBlock that emerged 5 years ago. And their primary mission is to address health equity and disparities. They've built practices in disparate communities. They manage through a value-based model. They provide value-added services that meet the needs of the patients in food insecurity, transportation, all of the things that we can think of, and trust and partnership around their care. That's an entire shift in thinking, right? And the emergence of a program and healthcare model that speaks just to health inequity. That's where I think the opportunities are. Now, I don't think, if I could just say this real quickly, I don't think all of us will do that necessarily, but there are opportunities, right, in providing those value-added services.
Yeah, so let me try to bring it all together. So I'm going to bring in my last question, have it connect to health equity. Put some context to it as well. Sure. So I think from a simplistic standpoint, the federal government and states have wanted to address underserved populations for a century, maybe longer. And the things that they've done to address that are captured in a simple man's mind in Medicaid, a blossoming Medicaid program that's grown to be a few hundred billion dollars in size. You know, started at one, it's much larger now. And in social programs funded at state levels, hundreds and thousands of them, at a federal level too, addressing unmet populations beyond Medicaid that fall outside of Medicaid that have in over history attracted hospital interest. You know, I'll help you if you fund it, and have attracted nonprofit interest. I'll help you if you fund it. I do suspect, and I'm getting to my question, that the government recently has seen the power of profit incentive, well-funded initiatives that attract for-profit entities in the context of value-based care. You know, value-based care has been initially a hospital experiment, health system experiment, and more recently has been a for-profit, you know, outpatient, multi-site MSO experiment funded by public companies, public markets, and private equity. And I just suspect, and here's my question, in terms of what's coming next from the federal government and then further down into the state level, you might see, because coordinated care seems to be working somewhat, government funding increase towards the problem and the solutions of health equity. Health equity being a coordinated care problem in itself, hard to fix health inequity with one solution. So what are your thoughts on that? Are you seeing the beginnings of interesting, well-funded, for-profit products coming out of the government and state level, acting as underwriters, acting as payers?
I have not. What I see is a commitment for funding as an incentive. And so what I mean by that, so you mentioned Medicaid. There may be additional funding, right, to support the non-medical services. Medicaid already provides us, but there may be additional support to provide the non-medical factors of care. So we know that 80% of good, healthy living are non-medical, right? The social determinants that drive good, healthy living. And so while Medicaid was essentially a payer providing the medical service, it was not a coordinated effort to address the whole care of the person and their social services, but again, it was not coordinated care. So what I see is from a federal level, the funds to pull those services together to ensure that there's coordination and that the non-medical needs are met and that the providers of those services, right, have revenue to support them. I see ACO REACH for the first time in a CMS program includes a health equity component, which is an added incentive to providers that participate in ACO REACH. And the edict really is to develop sort of what they think is the right model, what the provider thinks is the right model. And the core test really is to provide access, right? So that's a core component, right, of the inequity issue. And so I'm looking forward to seeing sort of what we learn there and what studies will show. But if you look around at the landscape, there are emerging healthcare delivery models that are forming to address this issue specifically. Some of those are privately funded. Not all are government funded. So I think it's early, but we do see some emergence, right, from the government perspective and private perspective in this space.
Thank you. I think it's going to be a wonderful opportunity. And I think there's going to be a lot of growth in that market.
I agree.
Now that the country has caught the coordinated care bug, because as long as that product works and yields better results, there's going to be a very well-funded group out there willing to pay for it, is my estimation. These things move quickly, but they still take time. I want to open it up to the rest of the group to see if anyone has any questions for Margaret.
Hey, Margaret, it's Carl.
Hey, Carl.
Very insightful points you made this morning. Thank you, and Roy. Do you see capitation in its form today ultimately being replaced in a broad sense by value-based care, or will it continue to exist in some shape or form?
I think it'll continue to exist in some shape or form. I mean, we know that in the current CMS models, there's a level of capitation and fee-for-service. In value-based models administered by payers, there's fee-for-service and capitation. So I think it'll continue to exist and utilized in a model when it makes sense and if the payer is able to administer capitation.
Same question for fee-for-service.
Yeah, I think fee-for-service will continue to exist. I mean, it's a sound model that you know, takes into, you know, the factors are geographic, relative value, effort, conversion factor. I mean, you know, it's a well thought out formula, not perfect, but I do think fee-for-service will continue to exist, and I see them both existing in current models and have no indication that fee-for-service will go away. I think the challenge with fee-for-service is always the same. It's transactional, and you know, there's real no accountability, right, with fee-for-service billing. It's not fixed, right, and it's a difficulty in controlling that cost, but in some aspects, I think it's necessary. So some specialties.
Margaret, Steve, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Steve. I'm well. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing these great insights.
You're welcome.
When we look at the evolution of everything you've talked about this morning, becoming more prominent in the delivery of care, I'm hearing more and more the discussion around hybrid. I've got a fee-for-service based reimbursement or payer mix model, and we want to infuse some form of value-based care and create a hybrid. Are hybrids realistic? And then I've got a second question after you answer this.
Sure, they are realistic, because if you think about the market, Steve, you have different size primary care groups and different size membership population. So where you typically see fee-for-service, or let's call it a hybrid, a fee-for-service and a value arrangement, is between 250 and maybe 1,000 members, where the primary care is being reimbursed by fee-for-service or capitation, and then layered on top of that, a value program, right? Additional incentive bonuses, right, for meeting certain outcomes, HEDIS measures, whatever it is, right? So I do think we will continue to see hybrids, especially for those smaller practices that don't meet the membership threshold for the shared savings or high-risk models.
Okay. Thank you. And the next question really relates to all of us. As value-based care evolves and becomes more prominent in these historic fee-for-service practices, what is the infrastructure required? What are the differences in infrastructure requirements to support value-based care versus fee-for-service?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. So I'm only pausing because I'm thinking of sort of a succinct answer here for you. So, and we're walking through this with one of our practices now. What's the right supports for the practice to manage well, right? And how do you maximize your revenue? So it really requires analytics, which is not an individual, but it is a resource that's necessary, that can understand, that can pull from your system, right, the patients that are in these value programs, unless you manage in a payer agnostic way, right, but can manage those in a value program, excuse me, to ensure that the metrics attached to those patients are met. So it's prospective and it's retrospective in a way. In other words, identifying for the provider, right? You're going to see blah, blah, blah today. She needs her annual wellness if it's Medicare Advantage, right? And it's time for her A1C and she's not taking her medication because the pharmacy feeds into your system and says she hasn't gotten it filled in 60 days. So it's the infrastructure, the analytics, but it's in the human being, right, that is calling the member. So the resources vary depending upon the value model, but they're essentially the same. Although as you go up the continuum, you need patient navigators, medical directors, you know, it's a plethora of resources you need depending upon where you're on that continuum. But it really starts, I think, with good, strong analytics and office support that will engage with your patient base to ensure that you are meeting those measures.
Thank you.
Yeah. And so I want to ask Melissa, who has worked in a CIN, please add in here, Melissa, if you have some additional thoughts. Oh, wait, is she on the call?
Yep, I'm here. Yep, okay. Yes, I am. Right.
Yeah.
Yes, thanks, Margaret.
Uh-huh, sure.
The key things that I would add here regarding the CIN, and Steve, you alluded to hybrid, but I would like to shift gears to a hybrid CIN. And what I mean by that is a hybrid CIN where you have employed physicians and independent physicians. And those are two very, there's critical differences when it comes to the incentive, the financial reward for those physicians, the distribution of any shared savings model. And in an employment model, you know, the physicians actually, it becomes part of their integral employment contract versus having the independent physicians where are they as invested, right? And what criteria can you put in place to make sure that everybody is aligned? In addition to that, the employed physicians have access to all of the resources that a hospital system or a health system has. So you asked, what is important? How are you successful in a value-based contract? The care teams, nurse navigators, dietitians, just nurses in and of themselves. Within an employed model, that's an integral part of a care team. For an independent physician, the overhead, a pharmacist, oh my goodness, to have that as an integral part of your team are exorbitant fees, right? So that's a little bit that I wanted to add about the CIN. And historically, my experience with the CIN where I worked, we had a total of 2,200 providers. 1,800 of those providers were employed. I'm accustomed to working in that hybrid model, but there are definitely differences when it comes to the resources that they have access to. So, and Margaret, I was actually going to unmute to ask a question, going back and pulling on your experience with contracting within providers. Sure. So if I've answered that satisfactory, if there's any questions about CINs, I'm happy to take those at this point. If not, I'd like to ask a question.
Yeah. Steve, are you finished with your question?
I'll tag on to both you and Melissa. We all have great operating experience in our former lives as we spent time in our career with staff, with physicians. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking of everything you said this morning, Margaret, of an old adage, when you're trying to consolidate, standardize, improve process, policy, procedure. I remember a physician saying, Steve, I love this. I'm all for progress. It's the change I can't support. And it really gets down to staff, provider, employee behavior. Mm-hmm. And in this hybrid model, it's rarely 50-50. Mm-hmm. But you've got two distinct different incentives, you know, fee-for-service production-based, and then mm-hmm. whatever the incentives are mm-hmm. for the stakeholders in value-based care. From a behavior standpoint of all those engaged in delivering care, how do you manage these two different economic engines of care, if you will, mm-hmm. with the same staff? I almost feel if I was involved here, I'd have to deliver dyslexic behavior to meet my goals.
Right. So the fee-for-service is most familiar, right? They continue to do what they've always done. And I also want to say here, in your lower continuum of your value-based models, where you essentially have two contracts in existence at one time, the conflict, I think, really, it's not a conflict. The challenge, I think, is changing the behavior to align with value. The fee-for-service is already very familiar, and I don't think is a challenge, right, for most physicians. The other thing I want to say here is that accountability in these situations does not just sit with the provider. The payer is still accountable, right? So the payer is also in a position of giving feedback through performance reporting for value and feedback on your fee-for-service billing. So that hasn't stopped, right? That continues to exist. In terms of how you're billing, volume you're billing, level of codes that you're billing. So the payer is still a partner, more so than if you're in a risk position where 85% of the dollar is yours and you pay everybody out of that 85%, right? You're on the hook for it. So I just wanted to say that, you know, the boundaries still exist around fee-for-service. The guidance still exists, the partnership with the payer, and then value it becomes the challenge in terms of changing behavior.
Right. And there's a term that I used often when I was trying to change that behavior within the practices in the value-based programs, and that was that our behavior needed to be payer agnostic. Now, maybe I drank the Kool-Aid on actual value-based, but I truly believe that there are fundamentals within value-based care that are the right thing to do, regardless of what insurance card is in that patient's wallet. It's a good thing for a patient to get a phone call within 24 hours of being discharged from a hospital and have a review of those medications with a nurse. It's a good thing for social services to reach out to a frequent flyer who is running to the emergency room because there could be potentially behavioral health issues there that are actually the underlying issues. So to treat that patient with those fundamentals of value-based care regardless and to be payer agnostic is key. But you're right, Steve, it's changing behavior and that takes quite some time. So Margaret, my question, we've talked a lot about physicians and providers, mm-hmm. but value-based care goes beyond that to health systems as well and mm-hmm. hospital systems. Mm-hmm. I'd love to hear, and I know we only have 10 minutes, but you know, typically in contracting, when provider contracts are 5 to 10 years for health systems or hospitals, they come back to the payer and they're always looking for a raise, right? Because we know mm-hmm. that the government, right, the government payers, they're not dishing out huge raises. So mm-hmm. they've got to get their money from somewhere. From your experience, did you see the beginnings of weaving value-based into mm-hmm. hospital and health system contracting
absolutely.
So that everybody is held accountable? Would love to hear
absolutely.
About that.
Absolutely. Case study. Huge health system here in North Carolina, lasted a year. Their Medicare Advantage rate was 105, 107. If just to level set, the Medicare Advantage rate typically now is 100% if you have the volume of a health system, and less if you do not, for a provider. we, and in this case study, we were introducing value for the first time. So this was 2015-16, right? And an increase was on the table, a request for an increase, and the EDIP was absolutely not. And so the discussion, like it literally over a year, became, you are a partner. Eventually, this health system carried over 40,000 members in Medicare Advantage with a wraparound benefit of a $0 copay. But before that, the discussion really was shifting your spend from fee-for-service to value. And we actually did what we call a glide path, where we took 1% of their Medicare spend and tied it to value over 3 years. And so there was eventually a shift from fee-for-service to value, but it was a long conversation on how we would be able to accomplish that. And we came out with a value program that was customized for that particular health system. In this case, the health system had over 1,000 physicians, 400 to 500 of them were primary cares, and the other were specialists, subspecialists. Obviously, they had all of the ancillary infrastructure, ED, the entire thing. And so, yes, and they are long, difficult discussions, because if you think about the tenets of value, you're looking for outcomes, and some of those outcomes have to do with quality, but some of them have to do with cost reduction. And you're saying to a health system who wants to keep their beds full, we're trying to move patients out of your hospital, right? And we're trying to move patients out of your ED and into the right setting for their care at the right cost. And so, yes, you have to dig deeply, but that's where partnership evolves. One of the things I so deeply saw just in a contracting role is that a fee-for-service negotiation can be adversarial. Value conversation becomes a partnership. How do we together render the right care at the right cost with the right outcomes for the member, the payer's member, and the health system's patient? And when you make that shift, then together you work at getting to the right position and the right percentage of value. I read a statistic recently that said value-based shift, and I want to say shift because it's all of the quality, all that goes with value-based, becomes really profound and felt when a health system has about 50% of their population in a value model. And I saw that with this health system. I saw a major, major shift. There was a major investment on their part, right, with their EMR, and there was a major shift and investment in building out a clinical team. In the end, it was beneficial from a revenue perspective and to the market when you think 40,000 people in one market, just in Medicare Advantage, are beginning to have different health outcomes, right, because of this model. So the answer is yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And did you say the glide path was 1% of Medicare? One as in one.
In this case study, 1% of their Medicare spend. So let me say their spend was in the billions. So I won't go any further than that.
We're reaching the end of our time for this morning. Is there anyone else that has a last quick question? Okay, I want to say, Margaret, thank you very much for your time, and we learned a lot, and look forward to the finished product as we publish our next article. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Bye, everyone.